From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In some ways, this was the first real week of the Bush presidency, the week when he stepped out from behind the curtain and laid his policies before the Congress and the country. New York Times White House reporter Frank Bruni wrote that he navigated that juncture with a steady voice that betrayed few, if any, traces of nervousness.
Reporters complained during the campaign that candidate Bush was too sheltered by his aides, too unavailable to the press. The aforementioned Frank Bruni joins us now on the line. Mr. Bruni, how about President Bush? Is he more accessible?
Since he's been in the White House, access has been extraordinarily limited. His public appearances have been, assiduously staged. It was a month before he held a news conference.
Let me ask you an odd question here. Is access all it's cracked up to be? I know it makes the job a lot easier for reporters, but does it make for better information to the news consumer? I mean, if he's out there giving interviews, he can put his own spin on things, and quotes are good, but the real information is in the analysis of the impact of his policies anyway.
Yeah, well, I think access is, I think you touched upon something important. Access is, in a sense, overrated because if we're doing our jobs well, there should be a heavy dose of outside commentary, of perspective, of analysis that has nothing to do with simply repeating the words that come out of his mouth. On the other hand, to the extent that I understand George W. Bush and have any sort of sense of what he's like, that comes from access. In hearing what he chose to talk about, how he talked about it, I learned a whole lot about him as a person that I hope informs any number of stories and has nothing to do with simply repeating the words out of his mouth.
Mm-hmm. But after he gave the tax cut speech, you said it marked a turning point in his charm offensive from the grace period to the uncertain, contentious work of getting his policies passed. And actually, in an article you wrote after his first press conference, you again referred to the press being on the receiving end of his charm offensive. Do you find the charm offensive offensive?
No, I personally don't, but it only goes so far. Whether it's directed at the media, whether it's directed at people on Capitol Hill, there is a moment at which everybody's self-interest or convictions are what they are, and those aren't going to necessarily be moved by the fact that one finds the person trying to persuade them a pleasant, nice person.
Absolutely. I'm just curious about the choice of the phrase. Charm offensive, as a phrase, is a lot more charged than some alternative phrases you could have gone with. Why does charm offensive, rather than diplomatic or politically adept, best describe what Bush is doing?
To say that it best describes it would flatter myself, and I wouldn't do that, and I'm also not the only one who's used it.
It's been used all around the world.
Part of it is a term that's just gotten some currency, but I actually think it is a good term. If you take the glimpses you've had of Bush meeting members of Congress, a lot of what he's doing is not just having substantive discussions with them, is not just a sort of high level of diplomacy. A lot of it is simply, calling them by nicknames, asking them about their districts. I guess it is diplomacy, but it's so colloquial in nature, it's so folksy, and I think by intention so unloaded that it really amounts to an onslaught of charm.
Does he have a nickname for you yet?
I think he first called me Frankie Boy, and then I became Poncho or Ponchito.
Oh, boy. Let's talk about Bushisms for a moment. Do the mangled syntax stories say anything beyond the fact that he messes up his words and maybe he does it a lot?
I think they say something else as well. One of the most important roles for a president is as a communicator. And I suspect that most Americans care less about some of his deficiencies as a communicator than those of us who listen to him all the time. But I think it is legitimate to point out when he has problems with that, because that could relate to his ability to inspire confidence in people, to bring them around to his point of view, all of which has a lot to do with whether he gets his agenda passed.
I wonder whether or not his mangled syntax hurts his confidence with the press more than with anybody else.
I think the public probably doesn't care enormously about the problems he has with the language, which aren't as rampant as I think sometimes comes across. he's got a real goofy streak to him, which I don't think he tries too hard to disguise, because I think he sees it, and I think his aides see it as something that helps him connect with a lot of Americans in terms of him coming across as unpretentious and folksy. I think our job as reporters is simply to lay it out there. And if people don't care about it, great, that's democracy. If they care about it, great, that's democracy. We're not necessarily trying to get people to turn off on him or to look down on it. We're just saying, here's a part of who he is, you know, and then readers can decide whether that's important or not.
Well, thank you very much, Pancho.
You're very welcome.
Frank Bruni is a White House correspondent for The New York Times.
George Bush has benefited from an age-old truism that dates back to about a month ago. It's hard for the media to tear apart more than one president at a time. If Bush is experiencing something of a honeymoon, Bill Clinton has been whipsawed by a Tijuana, or should I say Zurich, divorce. Which brings us to the Pundit Watch, as overseen by the Punditron 2000.
Punditron 2000 is the licensed property of Truthco International. At Truthco, they ain't buying your lion.
Pundits are like impressionist paintings, broad brushstrokes, but the closer you get, the less sense they make.
Numbers are not often the pundit's friend. Take this utterance by National Review editor Lawrence Kudlow on the McLaughlin Group.
The potential, and this local U.S. attorney is going to deal with it, is for a criminal conspiracy with respect to money. There may be other angles, John. There may be a sexual angle. Denise Rich apparently was in the White House 100 times. I mean, that's like a twice-a-week addiction.
If we ignore the lessons of history and set aside the sexual angle for a moment, we were wondering about the premise. Denise Rich visiting the White House 100 times was first reported by the New York Post and spread by the website Newsmax.com. A visit to Newsmax yields well over 100 articles on Pardongate. Some were leaks of supposed National Enquirer stories. Most simply reported how other media outlets had advanced details of Pardongate.
On the 100-time stat, Newsmax is living documentation of how a fact gets reported, repeated, and generally accepted for no reason other than the fact that if it were true, it would be cool. When Dan Burton mentioned the supposed 100 visits on the Fox News Channel, it further solidified the number. But then, on the very same Fox News Channel, Bill O'Reilly corrected the record. He said his own investigation had determined that there were fewer than 100 visits. Odd, then, that he should go on to say this on his appearance on David Letterman.
Now, what about, Denise Rich going to testify? Will we learn anything
there? If she has time, she was at the White House 100 times. I don't know if she can fit it in to her schedule. It's very busy.
Is that
taking
true?
A shuttle
was
and a walk.
Was she actually there twice a week for 2 years or a year?
There was a report on Newsmax or something like that. So Denise Rich had her own key to the White House.
But is that true? Is that true?
I don't know. She was there a lot. She had a lot of access.
Now that brings up an interesting
question.
Do you try to make sure everything you talk about is true, or you just talk about whatever you feel?
We
like
will
about?
if
because it's a whole different deal.
Newsmax reported the exchange as O'Reilly tells Letterman he reads Newsmax, but that's not good enough for the Punditron 2000. Let's put the 100-time stat through the Punditron.
Less than 20 times, the AP, the Washington Post, the New York Times, all say their sources put it at less than 20 times. So America can rest easy. It wasn't about the sex. It was about the bribery.
Unless it was about sex. Editorial pages have frequently weighed in with discontent about criminal sentences, whether too heavy, too light, too open-ended, or too inflexible. At least one judge, however, has asked the press for its opinion not ex post facto, but in advance. In the conviction of Avon Lake, Ohio Mayor Vincent Urban on corruption charges, visiting judge Richard M. Marcus, through another court officer, solicited from 4 newspapers comments or recommendations on the mayor's fate. According to the Cleveland Plain Dealer, one of the newspapers invited to comment, all 4 editors declined. Judge Marcus joins us now. Welcome to On the Media.
I'm pleased to be with you.
You asked newspaper editors to offer their opinions about a forthcoming sentencing. What was your motivator?
Ohio has a specific statute that directs that the judge at a sentencing hearing shall permit various persons to make any comments and may permit any others. The legislature gives me specific directions about how to accomplish the sentence, and those are the standards that I must apply. But to the extent that anyone can give me information that helps me apply those standards, I'm pleased to receive it.
And sometimes a judge simply has to solicit this information.
Well, I didn't solicit in that sense. You know, it's not unusual for news media to express their views. That's what editorial opinions are for. It seems to me that it would be more sensible if they wish to express such opinions that they do so before the sentencing occurs instead of afterwards. I think of it as something like making a political endorsement shortly after the election occurs. It has no impact then.
In your long and distinguished career, have you taken your share of criticism from newspapers in your jurisdictions?
Indeed, I have had comments that my sentence was too harsh. I've had comments that my sentence was not sufficiently harsh. And again, I think that's one of the reasons why news media might better communicate earlier, because I can better explain why the legislature commands the decision that I make. Really, this is not whimsical. I typically have to make something in the area of 50 factual decisions in deciding on an appropriate sentence.
But you weren't in any way being pointed with this request, where you weren't kind of twisting the knife and saying, all right, wise guys, if you're so smart, why don't you recommend a sentence beforehand instead of
waiting to play Monday morning quarterback? The letter expressly says that the judge will follow the legislature's directions and looks only for any information that will facilitate that process.
What would motivate a judge after all these years on the bench to suddenly start seeking input from such an unexpected source?
First, I don't consider it an unexpected source, and I would like to suggest that all of these years, as you put it, helps me to think and learn and consider other options that may help me do my job more effectively.
Had a newspaper editor weighed in with a point of view directly to the judge instead of on the editorial pages of the newspaper, do you think this raises ethical concerns?
Not to me. We believe in our nation that you should have a right to express your views and express your views to your government. And I, as part of that government, am quite willing to listen to other people's views.
All right. Thank you, Judge Marcus. Thanks so much
for
joining us.
Pleasure chatting with you. Thank you.
Coming up, Professor Gore greets guest lecturer Rupert Murdoch at Columbia Journalism School, the National Enquirer drifts towards the mainstream, or vice versa, and Jesse and the Jackals.
This is NPR's On the Media.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 2 weeks ago, the media swarmed on the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism as Professor Al Gore presented his first lecture, off the record, as it turned out. Well, the glow is off that story, and most of the swarm has moved on to such subjects as tax cuts, moles in the FBI, and dubious presidential pardons. Not on the media, however. Determined to lead the nation in reporting on the Gore syllabus, we focus now on Al Gore's third classroom foray, featuring a visit from press lord Rupert Murdoch, chairman of News Corp, which counts among its holdings Fox Television and the New York Post.
At first glance, Murdoch seems an odd choice for Gore. It was Fox News, after all, that was the first network to call the election for George W. Bush, and many consider Fox the most right-leaning of the networks. Fox Television also hasn't won any journalism awards for its special conspiracy theory, Did We Land on the Moon? So what was Gore thinking? Once again, Bob debriefs grad student Michael Arnone.
Michael Arnone is a student in Vice President Gore's class. Michael, welcome back to On the Media.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Did Professor Gore stake out a position on this, or was he a kind of Socratic broker of discussion?
This was not so much a Socratic give and take as him testing Mr. Murdoch on news events and asking for his interpretation of them. For example, he asked Mr. Murdoch, you know, Time Warner and CNN was not accused of forwarding the political ambitions of Ted Turner, while News Corp and the Fox News Channel, there's a lot of talk in the press about it being a squawk box for Mr. Murdoch's political beliefs.
How did Mr. Murdoch respond to the implication that he is using his multi-billion dollar corporation as a vanity press for his conservative politics?
Well, he admitted it. I mean, he admitted that that as a publisher, it's his role, it's his duty to be involved in the operation and the editorial end of his news operation. But he was also equally insistent that his news organizations do give a fair reporting of the news.
You know, if you had to select an obvious guest star for Vice President Gore, it wouldn't have been Rupert Murdoch, because if ever there were a politician who has reason to be hostile towards Mr. Murdoch, it's Vice President Gore. Was there any evidence of that tension there today?
None at all. If you didn't read the Post headlines, or if you didn't hear the Vice President's responses, you would never have known that there was blood in the water for most of last year in the national media market.
Rupert Murdoch has embraced tabloid values in many of his news properties. I suppose that those values are more or less antithetical to the mission of the Columbia School of Journalism. Was the class itself hostile, or shall we say just pointed, in the questioning of Mr. Murdoch?
Oh, pointed, yes, hostile, no. We found out, I think, last Friday that Mr. Murdoch would be joining us, and everybody's been sharpening their brains and sharpening their pencils, trying to think of just the right question to get him.
Well, then someone must have asked about the Man on the Moon documentary.
Actually, Vice President Gore brought that up. And Mr. Murdoch said that he would take no responsibility for it because he hadn't watched it. The discussion of tabloidism came at the end of the lecture, and what Mr. Murdoch said is that tabloids are dying in newspapers and rising in television because they appeal to the common man.
And that gives him license to pander to their sensibilities by making television shows on patently preposterous subjects. I mean, the moon thing is just one of the great outrages of tabloid journalism in any medium. Did anyone follow up on that and demand a better answer than he hadn't seen it?
Well, unfortunately, since it was at the end of the class, we were kind of going through questions at a rather rapid clip. He did not claim credit for having that run on his network. He even claimed that he didn't even know if it had run on his network, and the class reminded him that it did.
That sounds a trifle disingenuous to me.
Hey, I'm a reporter. I'm just calling as I saw it.
Well, reporter, next time, follow up. Inquiring minds want to know. Michael Arnone, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Michael Arnone is a student in Professor Al Gore's class at Columbia Graduate School of Journalism.
These are glorious days for the tabloids. The hottest publication in America right now is the National Enquirer, observed the Washington Post this week, and no one in the establishment press is snickering. Two big scoops in 6 weeks. First, about Jesse Jackson's love child, and second, uncovering through investigative reporting, also a little checkbook journalism, that Hillary Rodham Clinton's brother had been paid for securing a presidential pardon for a crook. Stephen Plowman is the assistant executive editor of the National Enquirer. Mr. Plowman, do you think the Enquirer is moving into the mainstream, or is the mainstream moving into tabloid territory?
I think it's mostly the mainstream moving into tabloid country. I remember when I joined the Enquirer 14 years ago, it would be the Enquirer, People magazine, maybe the British tabloids. vying for the same stories, you know, whatever it was, the world's oldest mother or a show business story, a royal story. Today, we're competing against NBC News, the mainstream daily newspapers. It's really a different ballgame.
But we're not talking about the world's oldest mother here.
No, we're not. And there's no doubt the Inquirer is doing more politics. But you have to remember, we're not new to this game. In 1987, we were the paper that ran the picture of Gary Hart with Donna Rice on his lap. So we've been doing this for a while. But I think the change that has come for us is that politicians market themselves more like celebrities today. And our readers are more interested in them in the same sense they are interested in Tom Cruise or Liz Taylor. It started with Ronald Reagan. He was from Hollywood. And Bill Clinton, he was just like a Hollywood star as far as our readers were concerned. And we covered him the same way.
I believe some reporters say that that Bill Clinton was pretty much God's gift to the National Enquirer.
He was great. We loved him. We're sorry to see him go. George W. is boring in comparison. You had, you know, a philandering husband. You had the wife who was kind of stern and cold. And you had a daughter who people felt sorry for. There were all the elements of, you know, great tabloid stories. And we love Bill. And he's still providing us with great stories even after he's out of office.
And as you say, if the mainstream press is moving into tabloid territory, they're also citing the National Enquirer on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post, an Enquirer exclusive.
They didn't used to do that, but on these last couple stories, the Jesse Jackson mistress story, which we broke a few weeks ago, and then this pardon payoff scandal that we broke, the mainstream media gave the Enquirer credit where credit is due, so that's terrific as far as we're concerned.
So do you think the stigma then is being lifted from the National Enquirer?
Well, you know, the Enquirer name is it's notorious. It's a household name. I don't know if we're ever going to get away from what we are, which is a loud, brash tabloid. When I went to journalism school, and I don't know about you, but I remember the professor talking about having to balance what the public wants to know with what the public needs to know. In other words, you give them a few fun stories that they would enjoy, you know, sports stories or comics or lifestyle section stories. And then you give them the tax stories and the boring stories about the sewers and so forth that they need to read to make decisions in their lives. Well, the Enquirer is all about what you want to know. And, you know, the need-to-know stories, those can go to Time and Newsweek and AP and so forth. But the best journalism for the Enquirer or for anybody else for that matter is the stories that combine both those things. And that's what we try to do. Those are our best stories. Those are our blockbusters.
Well, speaking of blockbusters, you mentioned that you ran the picture of Gary Hart back in the mid-80s, and it was around the mid-80s when the National Enquirer lost about half its circulation between 1986 and 1999. Earlier this month, a report came out that the circulation is continuing to drop. All of this respectability, do you think it's just a coincidence, or is it killing your paper?
I don't know. That's a very good question. I'm not sure the dynamics at work here. I think the fact that the mainstream media does do what we used to do alone certainly has cut into our circulation. Television, if you watch Dateline, rather, it almost is like they took the format of the Enquirer and designed it for television. It's very, very close. It's human interest stories that are kind of sensational mixed with some celebrity reporting.
Do you have a strategy for getting the circulation back up?
Well, our strategy is for getting these great blockbuster stories. When the New York Times says that, you know, we're the paper of record in the O.J. Simpson murder case, I think that really helps us. And we're hoping some people will give us a second look.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Stephen Plowman is the assistant executive editor of the National Enquirer.
Minnesota Governor Jesse "The Body" Ventura hates the press, and he doesn't care who knows it. Although he did change his mind this week about forcing reporters to wear press credentials identifying themselves as official jackals, he hasn't really let up. This week at the National Press Club in Washington, he said he wasn't going to spend a single dollar on his next campaign. After making that news, he added that all the other governors were meeting with Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. I hope Minnesota doesn't suffer because I jumped in with a bed of jackals, he said. From Minnesota Public Radio, Michael Koo prepared this review of the titanic battle between the body and the press corps.
Before we get started, an admission. I'm one of the so-called jackals of Minnesota's Capitol Press Corps with my own, by now infamous, jackal pass. The governor's change of heart makes the badge no more than a curious memento these days, but it wasn't always so, as Ventura made clear during his first press conference after distributing the badges.
By the way, I noticed that only a few people are wearing their credentials today. Congratulations for having a sense of humor, for those that do. And to those that don't, go stick your head in the mud.
You would need a sense of humor, at the very least, to wear the credential. It features a full-body photo of the body, wagging his finger at the camera. In the corner, it contains the reporter's name, organization, and the label Official Jackal. Several news organizations, including Minnesota Public Radio, instructed their reporters not to wear the passes, calling them unnecessary and unprofessional. Some also objected to a warning that the governor's office could revoke the passes at any time for any reason. Ventura, in his familiar, blustery style, took to the airwaves to fight back.
Well, we're going to jump right in. Good morning, everyone.
Ventura once was a jackal himself, hosting a daily radio call-in program. As governor, he now broadcasts a weekly show, Lunch with the Governor. It's his opportunity to connect with Minnesota voters, as his promo puts it, unedited, unfiltered, and unabashed. On a recent program, the governor daydreamed about calling a press conference, but not inviting reporters. Only cameramen, he said, and presumably camera women, could ask questions.
You never hear the cameramen complain, and in fact, quite often you see them laughing. Because I always feel, you know, they understand my mode of entertainment. You know, I think the cameramen are by far brighter than the reporters.
The Capitol Press Corps may beg to differ. St. Paul Pioneer Press reporter Jim Ragsdale has covered four governors in more than 10 state legislative sessions. He says reporters aren't as thin-skinned as the governor may think, but that the governor's credential was the straw that broke the jackal's back.
I think it is more the culmination of 2 years of extreme difficulty, trying to be fair to him, trying to walk the line, trying to tell people what he's doing, trying to give him the benefit of the doubt, and constantly being shut out, constantly being blown off when I ask reasonable questions.
In fact, on the same day Ventura backed down on requiring the passes, he stormed out of a press conference after a reporter interrupted him. The governor's relationship with the press has been rocky throughout his 2 years in office. Before that, on the campaign trail, Ventura was more accessible, and his shoestring operation found free publicity in newspaper, radio, and television reports. Now, Ventura says the media sensationalized their coverage, and he says they distort his image and his policies. A recent headline in the Minneapolis Star Tribune reported Ventura's budget would cut education funding. In fact, the governor's budget increases that funding, but not as much as some educators feel is necessary. The governor says the paper's correction was too little, too late.
People still today are coming up to me in Minnesota saying, why are you cutting education? Because the damage was done. The damage was put into that public's mind through a headline in the paper.
The governor's list of reporters' sins is a long one, even blaming the media for the dismal ratings of the XFL Football League, for which Ventura provides color commentary. Ventura implied reporters have a personal grudge against WWF impresario Vince McMahon, co-founder of the XFL. The Pioneer Press's Ragsdale says he found the governor's theory, quote, amazing.
I'm not saying that we don't commit sins, but surely we commit them sort of like referees do. We make mistakes, but we spread them around, and he is somehow the only politician who is offended and who is harmed.
The offense apparently runs both ways, which brings us back to the press credentials. Several reporters felt the passes were an attempt to control or limit access to the chief executive and cited the revoke for any reason clause. Ventura spokesman John Woodley says he wasn't prepared for that reaction, particularly what he calls the high and mighty tone.
Well, I was insulted to think that these organizations would believe that my intent or the governor's intent was to prevent the news organizations from getting access to the governor's office and in some way not recognize your First Amendment right.
Woodley says reaction from the rest of the world has been more positive. He He says he's received several hundred requests for the Jackal badges from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, even National Public Radio. But Woodley says he's denied all such inquiries. For now, the sleeping dogs lie. For On the Media, I'm Michael Koo in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Amid all the hubbub about the George W. Bush presidency, many people forget that Brooke and I have occupied our lofty positions approximately as long as the president has occupied his. Naturally, this has generated quite a bit of mail. Pearl Hoenig writes, "What happened to this program? For the first time in a long while, I listened this morning and I was appalled. The show's two over-chirpy anchors," she said, "set my teeth on edge." Brooke, you don't think we're over-chirpy, do you?
Nah.
But Maria Jett from Excelsior, Minnesota, wrote that this show gets better all the time, seemingly exponentially. I enjoyed it from the beginning, but it seems to get tighter and spicier. And she singled out our feature on the mysterious movie sound effect, The Wilhelm, for special praise. She wasn't the only one. Lots of people, from sound editors to regular movie buffs, wrote in to tell us how much they loved Dave Surchuk's piece and how they now hear the Wilhelm everywhere.
Our segment on the coverage of the conflict in Israel also prompted a strong reaction. We began with a piece from The Field by veteran Middle East reporter Rick Davis, describing the perilous position of journalists there. Then we opened ourselves up for criticism, asking two media critics to pick our piece apart. Ellen Conford said she found the approach innovative. While the story was long and the time allotted for reactions kind of short, the two critics conveyed their opinions very clearly and succinctly. It was interesting to hear objections to symmetry and balance as not being necessarily fair, and the lack of historical perspective as not being fair either. David Sprunger from Walla Walla, Washington wrote, "I was not aware to what level journalists face danger in covering the story, nor was I aware how both Palestinians and Israelis claim the media's coverage is biased against them." But V. Dimitridis, who identified himself as a mercenary tank driver in the Golan Heights War, is neither surprised nor sympathetic. "Understand and accept the risks fully of what you do as a vocation," he wrote, "for the shirking of this will only foster resentment. It is the highest naivete of reporters to expect otherwise. Your outrage has a hollow sound when you walk into a fire and are shocked that you are burned."
If you want to tell us what you think about our show, you can write to us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. That's one word, onthemedia@wnyc.org. Please include the pronunciation of your name. We want to hear from you, and we can always use more eyes and ears on the media. If you've missed something from the show or you just want to hear something again, you can always tune in to onthemedia.org and listen via the web. And, of course, there you can also get free transcripts. You think Nightline will give you free transcripts? Think again. Coming up, a behind-the-scenes look at MTV's behind-the-scenes looks, plus how DVDs are changing the way we watch movies.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The information age is meant to describe an epoch, specifically the present or a little bit in the future, but it could just as easily apply to a stage of life, specifically people a little younger than you, unless you are a channel surfing, message texting member of the cohort called Generation Y.
A few years ago, marketers began to send kids the message, "You matter. Your tastes matter. Your discretionary income matters." Naturally, the kids agreed and sat back as 100 forms of media competed for their attention. MTV won. Recently, many MTV shows have taken as their central theme the other shows on MTV. Mike Pesca entered this endless feedback loop and emerged with this report.
To be a member of Generation Y is to have your every curiosity catered to. It's to know that you can clog your hard drive with information about the walk-on character who flitted across Dawson's consciousness for 2 episodes.
I think now in a culture of 200 channels and infinite internet content, what we want to do is deconstruct and understand every little aspect about how something is made famous and proliferated.
Brian Graydon is MTV's president of programming. That job once meant deciding if the 99 Luftballoons video would go into high rotation. Now a lot of the programming on MTV is shows about other shows on MTV. Take, for instance, the Video Music Awards.
What the hell was Rage Against the Machine bassist Tim C doing atop our set at the 2000 Video Music Awards?
The VMAs are more than the biggest night on MTV. Because of repeats, they're many, many nights. Tack on another dozen or so nights of reruns of the documentary on the making of the Video Music Awards. Brian Graydon explains the making of the first making of the VMAs.
You know, it was sort of almost accidental. We were sitting around maybe 3 years ago, and we were reminiscing about the Video Music Awards that we had loved, and then we realized, well, these are moments that really happened in culture. To get people excited for this year's show, why don't we go back and remind them how cool the prior shows were? So it sort of just happened as a promotional whim, and then when we first aired it, the ratings went through the roof. It was probably quadruple the time period, and it was like, oh my God, we could really mine this, because the audience seems to have an insatiable appetite for behind-the-scenes information.
Now, MTV has shown you our best this and hottest that, and counted down our 100 greatest other things. But now to celebrate MTV's...
These days, the M in MTV stands for Making Of. The making of the VMAs. The making of the movie awards. A new show called Making the Video. Brian Graydon says MTV's viewers identify. Those idiots on spring break, the cast of The Real World, the guy who won the contest to be a VJ. Graydon thinks every kid is secretly saying, hey, I can do that.
If you think about the people who are in the MTV generation now, they were raised on The Real World, on Monica Lewinsky, on OJ. They were raised on Survivor. So they're used to the fact that sort of relatively ordinary people can be plucked out of obscurity and suddenly made famous, and all the accoutrements of fame are open to them. So I think they're fascinated by that process because they're like, oh, my God, even if I'm not a talented singer or dancer or politician, that could be me. And so I think they want the process deconstructed to know how they get access to it.
The low-tech way of getting access is showing up in person. That's what dozens of MTV fans, some with guitars, do each weekday in an effort to be invited onto Total Request Live, MTV's popular after-school show based in Times Square. The kids left to shout from the sidewalks below served as the perfect focus group of heavy MTV viewers. John McSweeney told me that all the making-of documentaries do creep into his mind when he's watching the source material.
If I think, like, something in the Video Music Awards was cool or something was, like, you know, something, like, weird went on, yeah, then you look forward to seeing it. But otherwise, like, it's something fun to watch.
Interesting thing. Now, you were nodding your head. When you watch the awards, you kind of know that there'll be the special on it eventually?
Yeah, anything I want to know, I'm sure MTV would put it on. And...
Right, they're not going to deprive you of information
about
it. Exactly. At a certain point watching these specials, do you say, you know, enough already, I don't care that much about MTV?
I care a lot about MTV. Like him, whenever I'm home, I watch it. That's pretty much it.
So when you watch the shows about the shows on MTV, have you ever said to yourself, it's all just a big commercial for MTV?
Definitely not. There are a lot of great shows on it. I mean, it's one of the greatest channels out there, but it's not a big commercial.
Brian Graydon sees his audience as possessing a level of sophistication unfathomable to anyone who's ever had to get up to change the channel.
They can know, for example, a group like the Backstreet Boys was quote-unquote manufactured, right? Put together down in Florida. There are a lot of great producers, et cetera, behind. They can learn all that stuff in behind-the-scenes information. They can sort of know that there's a level of artifice to it because it's been deconstructed for them in a documentary. And at the same time, they're like, yeah, I know all that, but I'm still going to kind of enjoy the music and buy into the fantasy. I think they get it on both levels.
So many shows about so many shows has another effect. It trains the viewers to become perfect characters for other MTV shows. Take MTV's attempt at totally transparent programming, The Real World. Not only does MTV ask real people to live in front of a camera, they have to try out in front of a camera so that the losers can be humiliated by other real people on camera. It's the Real World casting special. Mike, whose dream it is to be on the Real World, has been paying close attention.
It showed me what not to do because, you know, people get on there and they're like stripping naked. They're running around naked. And the way I see it, they're looking for people that are real. You have to be real. You can't go do any of these like crazy stunts and stuff like that because that's not you. You're not being real.
A few years ago, MTV tried to put viewer submissions on the air in a program called You Wrote It, You Watch It. It flopped. But now, Graydon says the talent pool might be up to the challenge.
You know, by sheer coincidence, we're actually doing a pilot called My Life is a Movie, where we have asked our ordinary viewers, you know, age 19 or whatever, to send us stories, and you'll just be so amazed that the stories are completely literate to how they expect and know a script will, you know, break down. And so we are pursuing that idea today, even though it didn't work 5 or 10 years ago.
From audience to artists in 5 to 10 years. Even if only a tiny fraction of MTV's viewers ever become on-screen or off-screen talent, MTV will be able to stock its shelves with programming. The training videos are being delivered via cable lines into the homes of America 24 hours a day. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
MTV is following an important trend by always recycling and never throwing anything away. That seems to be the secret behind the success of the latest technological sensation, the DVD player. The DVD has penetrated the market twice as fast as the CD, almost 3 times faster than the VCR. Some 20 million players are predicted to be in American homes by the end of the year. The national fascination with DVDs has everything to do with what they manage to cram onto those little discs.
Did you know that in the film The Usual Suspects, you can briefly see a California palm tree in a shot that's supposed to be New York? Did you know that Michael Redgrave hated movie acting when he debuted in The Lady Vanishes? Did you know that in The Cell, Miss Universe's naked breasts were created digitally in post-production? You would, if you'd watch those movies on DVD. Special effects that offer juicy tidbits like these are the reasons the DVD player is the best-selling electronic device in history, says film critic Roger Ebert.
The DVD provides twice as much picture detail. It provides true surround sound. It provides all of these bells and whistles, all of the deleted scenes, the little essays, the making of documentaries, the advertising campaigns, the trailers. It's just like getting a whole package about the movie instead of just getting a fairly low quality tape.
DVDs, being the same size as CDs, are simpler than VHS tapes to handle and store and far less vulnerable to wear and tear. Ebert is thrilled because the high-quality image and sound allow home viewers to enjoy an experience much closer to the filmmaker's original vision. But you don't just see that vision. You can hear from the director, editor, cinematographer, designers, and actors exactly how they crafted it. And that is rapidly changing a nation of moviegoers into cineasts, full of all the arcane knowledge the word implies.
If you got 5 or 6 of the best DVDs, it'd be like taking a college course in filmmaking.
Richard Roper co-hosts Ebert and Roper and the Movies.
The first time you see a DVD picture in a DVD player, I think it's the moment you say, I'm no longer attached to my VCR.
Peter Becker, one of the pioneers of classic home video, is the president of Criterion, a company that meticulously transfers classic and contemporary films to DVD. The Criterion catalog ranges from RoboCop to Rashomon, and nearly every film is enhanced with additional tracks of expert commentary or rare bits of footage. For example, Criterion's vivid transfer of Carol Reed's 1949 The Third Man.
Graham Greene originally wrote The Third Man as a novel. He never had any experience of writing in script form, really. And Carol Reed said, fine, write me the novel and I'll make you the movie.
The DVD provides a reading of Graham Greene's original text over the video.
He called sharply, do you want anything? And there was no reply. He called again with the irascibility of drink. Answer, can't you? And an answer came, for a window curtain was drawn petulantly back by some sleeper he had awakened, and the light fell straight across the narrow street and lit up the features of Harry Lime.
Harry!
In the case of Grand Illusion, Jean Renoir's 1938 classic, the brilliant DVD transfer was the result of a lucky break, the recent discovery of a complete print captured and protected, first by the Nazis and then by the Russians after the war.
There's a part of it that is about detective work, and there's a great kind of satisfaction in that eureka moment when you find the things that you never knew existed.
Criterion's edition of Grand Illusion includes Renoir's own introduction to the film, recorded in 1958.
And I had a very good friend, a wonderful man, a great fighter. His name was Captain Passer. Captain Passer was shot down 7 times by the Germans. He was taken to a prison camp 7 times, and he escaped 7 times. The story of Grand Illusion is based on the evasions of Captain Passer.
Collecting all of the things that might be lost, but that are somehow related to the identity of a film, related to the mood in which it was made, that can be very much part of it. There's advertisements that were made for Life of Brian that are just hilarious, that would have just slipped into obscurity, and they certainly had before we came along.
My name is Muriel Cleese, and I live in a very nice elderly people's home in Weston-super-Mare. My son John is in the new Monty Python film, Life of Brian. Do hope you'll go and see it, because he's on a percentage, and he said if it doesn't do well, he won't be able to keep me on in the home any longer. I'm 102 years old, and if I have to leave here, it'll kill me.
One of Criterion's most ambitious productions is its three-disc rendering of Terry Gilliam's 1985 film Brazil, which includes the 94-minute studio release, the 142-minute director's cut, and a great deal more, including an hour-long documentary of Gilliam's famous fight with Hollywood.
I would get calls from the editor occasionally wanting my input. What do you mean you want my input? Yeah, but we're saving your film. No, you're killing my film. You're destroying it. You've taken the child, and you're asking which limb do you want chopped off?
For some filmmakers, the DVD version is the one for posterity, the final statement, the place for stray snatches of inspiration, selected sweepings from the cutting room floor. Richard LeGravenaise wrote The Fisher King and The Bridges of Madison County and wrote and directed 1998's Living Out Loud.
You can always tell yourself, well, at least I'll put it on the DVD and someone will get to see it. Whereas in the old days, it was just lost forever. It lessens the pain of losing one of your little darlings, which is what William Goldman, a great screenwriter, refers to as those pieces that are just so perfect, or perhaps a scene that was the whole reason you did the film. And then by the end of it, you realize it's the one thing that has to be sacrificed, like Isaac and Abraham.
DVDs have immense storage capacity, so much so that the DVD of Terminator 2 is able to include 3 complete versions of the film, plus an audio commentary with 26 members of the cast and crew, not to mention additional interviews, storyboards, featurettes, and trailers. Fantasia 2000 has an additional 11 hours of programming. And how about the interminable commentary for Battlefield Earth?
Huge kind of machinery. You're not quite sure what it does, but you know that
it's smoky, stinky, and everything. But something comes out of there that's beyond our explanation.
It's kind of steampunky.
Is there such a thing as too much information? Some directors, Steven Spielberg and Peter Weir, for example, won't do commentary tracks. And Criterion's Peter Becker said that Rob Reiner, as he sat down to talk through his film Spinal Tap, was frankly wary.
The very first thing that he said was, I can tell you a lot that will increase your understanding of how this movie was made, but it will very likely decrease your enjoyment. And he encouraged viewers to listen at their own risk.
But the inescapable fact that DVDs are flying off the shelves suggests that knowing the tricks of the trade, continuity and steady cams, pyrotechnics and animatronics, does not diminish the magic of the movies. It just brings you a little closer to the magician.
You talking to me?
You're doing something in a mirror.
You talking to me?
That idea fit the whole thing of somebody by themselves, talking themselves, acting that way.
Huh? Well, then who the hell else are you talking to? Talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here.
Listening to all those directors' commentaries has made us wish we had behind-the-scenes insights on big media events, such as when President Bush addressed the Congress this past week.
I know Congress had to formally invite me, and it could have been a close vote. So, Mr. Vice President, I appreciate you being here to break the tie.
We had so many more laugh lines at the top.
Right. What was it? He thanked the Supreme Court?
Right. The line was, and if the other side wins, we'll take it to the Supreme Court. And he thanks Bill Clinton for keeping the heat off of him.
And the Surgeon General or something?
No, it was a Surgeon General, because I'm going to be doing so much butt-kissing to get this thing passed. I'm going to need a lip transplant.
Funny stuff. But there's nowhere to go from there.
No, the Cheney line was the best.
Education is not my top priority. Education is my top priority, and by supporting this budget.
The famous fluff. Do you want to tell this one?
Sure. Nobody believes me, but it was in the script.
I know people will stop me on the street to this day to ask about that line, but that's exactly what we were after.
It was meant to give the viewer a sense of unease. Wait, what's he saying? Education is not my top priority? And then he comes right back.
Yeah, he comes back with education is my top priority. And it's like, I thought it was.
Exactly. If he just says the line as a line, no big deal. But if he prefaces it with that little flub, everyone talks about it.
Bush equals education because of the flub.
It's a little trick.
For an actor, I think it's the toughest line in the script.
Exactly.
With us tonight is the mayor of Philadelphia.
Of course, the mayor of Philadelphia was too expensive, so we had to get the mayor of Vancouver.
Can't tell the difference.
No, same thing.
I like teachers so much, I married one.
Now, that didn't test well.
No, you're right. When we screened it in Culver City, some of the cards that came back were from teachers themselves.
Right. A couple teachers who saw it at screenings were scared he'd be coming right after the next.
I'd never even thought of that when I wrote it.
No, but I thought it was a good line, so I fought for it. One of the few fights I won.
That's real money. With us tonight, representing many American families, are Stephen and Josefina Ramos.
Stephen and Josefina. Where did you come up with those names?
Those are the names of my grandmother's cats.
I never knew that.
Our parks are places of great natural beauty and history.
At this point, almost exactly halfway through the speech, we cut away to a montage sequence of Bush at play in the parks with walking on sunshine underneath them.
Katrina and the waves.
Exactly. George frolicking at Old Faithful, George teasing a family of bears, George twirling on a mountaintop. And we pull back, way back. It's an homage to the opening shot of Sound of Music.
Sublime. It's in the added features at the end of the disc.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Katya Rogers and Alicia Zuckerman with help from the Keefe Boys, John and Dylan. It was engineered by George Edwards and edited by Brooke. We also had help from David Serchuk, Kathleen Horan, and Rex Doan.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Our theme, not to be confused with this, was written by bassist composer Ben Allison. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Funding for On the Media is made possible by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bydale Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.